heavy heart sink you like a stone.
Right back where you last left off, Mr. Light interrupted. Was it love?
It wasn't. I suppose it is now.
That is unfortunate. Love will always have you at a disadvantage.
Being dead has made a disadvantage.
Many is the man who would take any version of his lost love rather than leave his love lost. He will say thank you to whatever God sent you back to him.
Well done. I will complete my task and deliver you into darkness.
My God! You're going faster!
Hello and welcome to Storm of Spoilers. You've stumbled upon an 8-episode miniseries dedicated to the Starz show, American Gods. I'm Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Gail Folsom.
Each week, the two of us, book readers and amateur Neil Gaiman experts, will unpack the latest episode of American Gods. Despite the name of this podcast, we will not be spoiling anything in this episode beyond Season 1, Episode 4, Get Gone, directed by Craig Zobel and written by Brian Fuller, Michael Green, and Maria Melnick. Before we dive into the episode, let's check in on a little listener feedback. Gail, what do we got this week?
Okay, first of all, we got a tweet from at Neon Raccoons, otherwise known as Sean O'Connor. And Sean says, gods are, quote, copies of former selves, which Wednesday alludes to with Jesus convo, which occurs in Kinko's where copies are made. And I liked this tweet just because we had talked in the last episode about somebody had sent us an email saying that they thought that the American Gods were sort of the 2.0 version of their counterparts in the old countries. And I think we had agreed to that. But I like this tweet because it points out that the whole conversation was happening in a coffee shop.
That literally never occurred to me.
I was like, oh, that was lost on me. Mm-hmm. That was a good, I don't know how intentional that actually was, but I choose to believe it was a very intentional choice on the part of the showmakers. And I like it.
Well, the Jesus conversation is not from the book. Like, the multiple Jesus is mostly out of the book, mostly.
I did enjoy in the last episode. Actually, he is referred to a few times in the book, mm-hmm. and it's always sort of as like, oh, Jesus. Like, all the other gods are kind of mad at how successful Jesus is. It's kind of great.
He's like the Beyonce of gods, and they're like, oh, this guy again. Ugh.
Yeah. And then for our email correspondence, we got an email about something I had said in the last podcast, in which I had said that I think, again, it was related to that old world gods versus the American new world gods, that the Mr. Wednesday version of Odin is sort of sleazy and he's a con artist and he does things that are beneath the dignity or the honor of the Norse gods as traditionally depicted. And this person, this is Justin Beeson, who writes in, hi guys, loving the show, but I have to disagree with the assertion Gail made that the traditional depiction of Odin wouldn't lie or be dishonest. In the story of him stealing the meat of poetry, he constructs a very elaborate con in order to get it. Wikipedia has a decent summary of it, and it's in Gaiman's Norse mythology as well for a more fun reading. That story sounds exactly like something that American Odin would do, especially the last part where he sleeps with the giantess guarding the mead in order to take, quote, sips of it, but instead swallows all of it. Justin is correct that in traditional Norse mythology, Odin is, on a couple of memorable occasions, dishonest. The difference, I would say, is that The Norse pantheon has a lying trickster god who is capricious. Like, he sometimes helps the gods out, but it's really like kind of on his own terms. And also, he is definitely the antagonist. And Loki, unlike other trickster gods, I would say also, he he's like, he is the ultimate con man. He's the inside man. He brings about the beginnings of Ragnarok, like single-handedly, just about.
The Marvel movie?
No. No. I mean, like, in a sort of inadvertent way. Yeah, I guess. It doesn't exist, I guess, without Loki. Anyway, we can hope. But the story that you're referring to, actually, Justin, every time Odin has one of these sort of critical, dishonest moments, it's sort of made much of in Norse mythology, actually. And this could be something that is a Christianization, or, you know, sort of a Westernization of those stories as they went down through history. But in this particular story, Odin feels so bad about what he did because, yeah, he, like, you know, seduces this lovely Jotuness who's sitting all alone. She's been tasked by her father with watching these pots of mead, and she's really bored and lonely about it. She doesn't want to do it. And here comes handsome Odin to regale her with stories and seduce her, and then steals all the mead and runs away. And now she's in trouble with her dad, and she's still all alone in Jotunheim, which sucks. So what Odin does, and this is like a very sort of, you know, Norse, I guess, way of making up for what he did. He takes her resulting son, Bragi, and takes him to Valhalla. And Bragi he becomes the god of poetry. And his wife, Idun, is the goddess of eternal youth. And she tends the tree with the apples of immortality. And so, or they're not quite immortality, whatever. They keep the gods young. They have to eat them all the time. Anyway, so there's that story in which he sort of makes up for it. There's also the story of Fenris, in which Odin is party to an enormous lie, where they tell Fenris, oh, yeah, this is just, we're just going to tie you up with this, like, seemingly harmless rope in order to test your strength. And they know perfectly well that he's not going to get out of it. And then they leave him tied up on an island forever until Ragnarok, again, when he gets loose. Again, Odin was really bothered by the Norse gods being party to a lie. And so I would say that while that's something, yes, out of necessity, that the Norse gods do, it's not their ideal. They're not proud of it. And every time that it happens, there's a cost, a known cost, or a penalty, or a reparation that needs to be made. And so I would say that's the difference between, say, you know, Loki's constant selfish lying that brings about destruction, and Odin's trying to bring about the greater good, which is actually sort of a very human attitude to take.
Would you say then that the American Odin is more like a shameless version of Odin?
He seems to care significantly less about the consequences, and he does it much more easily. It comes easier to him, is what I observe.
And so my other question is, I believe somehow you got your hands on a copy of this Neil Gaiman Norse mythology book. Would you recommend it as sort of extra reading for people watching American Gods? Yeah,
I would. It's a really wonderful book. It's very faithfully told, but in the wonderful Gaiman way of bringing these characters to life. So you are not going to be misled by reading it. It's not an academic work, but it will give you a wonderful flavor and a wonderful journey through these really great stories, because especially Norse mythology, there are many very funny stories. And like I said, you know, the characters, they're not quite as two-dimensional as sometimes the Greek gods are. And the stories don't all end with somebody being like, and then he was king and it was great, but he flew too close to the sun and then he died. You know, and there's a fatalism in a lot of mythology that the Norse mythology, there's a lot of fun and there's a lot of great stories. That's a wonderful book. Somebody else asked, actually, quick sidebar, and I am so sorry that I don't have this one open in front of me right now, but this was a tweet in which somebody had asked for recommendations of books of Norse mythology or any kind of mythology. And I told that person I strongly recommend, if you're just starting out and you're not at all familiar with these characters, the Dallaire's books of Norse and Greek mythology, which are technically children's books, but they're quite complete. They're very beautifully illustrated, and they're I would say they're kind of the gold standard for like beginner's mythology books for those two pantheons. And that person
I had that at
Goonie 74.
So I think we have one more email, but I think maybe it might be best to save that until we're sort of in the middle of talking about this episode, because it'll fit in perfectly. Does that sound like a good idea to you? All right, so let's get into this episode. Before we sort of go beat by beat, run down the episode, I wanted to get sort of general impressions, and I want to say that I personally think this is the very best episode of American Gods. I watched this when I went to go see the episode sort of early on before they were released to the public. They showed me episode 1, episode 4, and then a bunch of like little vignettes in between. But that's what I saw. I saw episode 1, I saw episode 4, and I saw a bunch of like little pieces in between. And as soon as I saw episode 4, I was like, okay, I'm in. Like episode 1, I wasn't sure, but episode 4, I was like, this is amazing, because, you know, as any of you who have read the book already know, this is completely extrapolated. It is not, you know, a sequence that's in the book at all. And so we get Laura's backstory, which is something that, like, you know, Laura is a character that is just not very well fleshed out, no pun intended, in the book. And I think that's actually true of a lot of the female characters in the book. I think, you know, and Gaiman has sort of admitted as such, they all sort of exist to serve Shadow. We're in Shadow's head. And so by that extension, we get a lot of these characters he meets are there to serve him generally, but I think the women most of all sort of get that one-dimensional role. We'll meet some women later on in the book who do the same. Gail, what did you think of this non-book faithful episode?
Well, my just being sort of, you know, pedantic, it was out of left field for me, because I was looking for, you know, more of what I liked in the books. I thought it was really well done, and I was really pleased to see Emily Browning.
Yep.
Being given a little bit more to do, and you know, just a chance to kind of flex her acting muscles there. She did a really good job of being very, very different from Shadow. Like, she made Shadow look so cuddly by comparison. Yes. Just positively effusive. And so I did enjoy that. But yeah, it was a very different episode from the ones that we've seen thus far. And I said, I think in our last episode, that the third one had left me with, you know, such a warm, fuzzy feeling. This one did not. Okay. Do that at all. No, this was I just thought it was darker, and it was a much more human episode. It was about the human experience. Yeah. And there was a lot of discussion of having no faith and not believing that there was anything else beyond this. So yeah, it was a tough episode. I think
it is entirely fine for us to disagree on the quality of the episode, but
I think it was a good quality. It was maybe not the one that I have enjoyed the most so far.
Well, so it's interesting because, you know, Brian Fuller, when he adapted Hannibal for NBC, he basically did this adaptation that had nothing to do, almost nothing to do with Thomas Harris books. Like, the, you know, Hannibal Lecter is a character, like all his characters are from the books, but like the plot has nothing. So like that adaptation he did was way sort of off the map of the books. And then, you know, the pilot, as we discussed, was very faithful of American Gods, was very faithful to the books. But I think
and it didn't necessarily work. So
it worked here and there. And I really do think the success of the series will be striking a balance between the two, of like really finding space to expand things while also, you know, hitting the beats of the book. I got to talk to Neil Gaiman about this episode, which I was pretty excited to do. That interview is up on vanityfair.com if you want to read it. He said this is his favorite episode because he felt like it was the first time that the show really came sort of like unshackled from the adaptation, while really, in his opinion, perfectly striking the tone of his story. He like, he thinks their telling of Laura's story is really faithful. He's like, it's all there. All the context clues are there if you read the book. They just sort of made it its own story, if that makes sense. And, you know, he said that he really does think, I'm extrapolating this from what he said. He was sort of talking about some of the challenges of season one. I think he and Brian Fuller and Michael Green would all agree that season one is not an unmitigated success, that he talked about sort of like them finding out what this series can bear and what it can't, like what this show should look like, and that he really feels like they'll have it figured out in season two. And anyone who's watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer will tell you that like a show can be very shaky in season one and then really hit its stride in season two. So that's what I'm hoping for. You know, like, you and I really are enjoying the show, but I think as they work more and more kinks out, it'll potentially be even better. And sorry, my cat just hopped up on me, and that's very apropos for this episode. I was actually really optimistic about this episode because filled with hope, because it really did to me feel like a great episode of television inside the world of American Gods, whereas the other episodes have felt like some very successful scenes based on the book American Gods. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. And I would totally agree with you that because this episode was so completely invented, mm-hmm. And it's not incongruous in any way with the story that is told in the book, but because it was so invented, this belongs entirely to the television series as a piece of artwork. And you know, Gaiman is no stranger to having his work adapted either for television or for film. And so And I would also say that, you know, compared to where he was in, 2000, 2001, when American Gods came out, as a writer, as a novelist, compared to where he is now, he's really trimmed a lot of the fat. He's really honed in on what it is that he wants to communicate about people's experiences. And I think The Ocean at the End of the Lane is a really perfect example of that. If you look at, you know, Sandman, where he started out, where he was just like gleefully repurposing all kinds of folklore and mythology because he loved it, to where he ended up with The Ocean at the End of the Lane, which is, I think, in my opinion, it's the best thing that he's ever done. It's a truly great story. And it has an extremely spiritual quality to it, a very mythological quality to it. I think that it's very appropriate at this point to start pulling in, to start reinterpreting and not just like faithfully following a book that is wonderful and I love it, but at the same time, you know, it needs to be reinterpreted for a number of different reasons, and it's got to have that added content. The book itself also, I think this episode pointed up to me the fact that the book itself is a little coldly told. It's, and I've said that before, it's kind of a, I don't know, it's sort of a brutal read, like just the there's a lot of harshness and pain and disappointment in the telling of the book and the way that the characters, what they go through and how they act. And so this was another moment for us to identify with those characters and feel their experiences.
So, okay, so let's dive into the episode and run it down real quick. I have the rundown here, and almost every single bullet point starts with the word Laura, because this is Laura's episode. So we first meet Laura, which in a sequence that I found really clever. The opening is starts off in the Egyptian casino where she works, the Anubis casino, and at first glance you sort of think you might be in an Egyptian tomb somewhere, but you know, then it pans over and you find out you're in a casino, but it's playing sort of the same theme music that it played when we met Anubis in an earlier episode, their Egyptian theme. And we see Laura and she's a dealer in the casino. In the books she is a small town travel agent, but as Neil Gaiman said in when he was talking to me, he's like, that's not a job that exists anymore.
No, you can't
That's gone now. So you know, so they gave her a new job. She works in the casino. We see her as she's a pretty depressed person. I would wager. She's got a cat that she calls Dummy and doesn't really care for. And we see her like right at the beginning of this episode, try to take her own life.
Not a great way. I didn't know.
I mean, pretty upsetting way, but this is where we get the title of the episode. Get Gone is the name of the bug spray that she uses when she tries to kill herself in this hot tub scenario. So, failed suicide attempt, but it establishes Laura as very unhappy in her life, very listless and unhappy with her lot. And then we go back to the casino, and that's where she meets Shadow, who's sort of trying some of his coin tricks to, which in the books is something he learned in jail, but I guess here is an interest that predates jail, and uses some of his sleight of hand coin trickery to try to rip off the casino, and she warns him against it. And as you said before, this is a very different Shadow than we meet elsewhere in the series. And you know, Gaiman, when he was talking to me, said that he really loved seeing this version of Shadow because it really drives home the point that version of Shadow before he goes into jail is dead, is as dead as Laura is.
Yeah.
The man who comes out the other side is a different man. And so it was important to see Ricky Whittle as Shadow in sort of full charm offensive mode here. What did you think of these early Laura scenes?
You know, just really quickly on Shadow, I ran across a quote in the book just recently, and it was a scene where Mr. Wednesday had done something particularly jarring and, you know, supernatural, and Shadow had just like not even reacted to it and just like, you know, picked up the keys and kept going, and Odin was kind of miffed about it. He was like, "What? You're not even going to say anything?" And Shadow was like, "Well, I just, you know, nothing seems quite the same anymore, and nothing seems real." And Odin says, "Oh, since Laura came back from the dead." And Shadow says, "No, since I found out that Laura was fucking Robbie," or whatever, you know. And it, to me, that was a very kind of moment, because he's so complacent and accepting about so many things. And it was, I think this episode, that quote would function well to sum up sort of his feelings for Laura and the place that she had in his life. You know, it was hard to watch Laura being so deeply depressed. And as you said, listless. There was just an ennui about her. It wasn't that she wasn't unhappy. She was just so deeply bored with her life. And the repetitive shots of her walking into the casino over and over and over again. And then they take away like the one thing in her job that she actually enjoys, which is shuffling the cards. And that was an interesting thing to me, because I spent the rest of the episode wondering, was she sad that they took away the option for the dealers to shuffle the cards because Laura liked to pull her own little secret cards or her own cons? Was it because she enjoyed having the element of chance in her own hands? That was an interesting thing to have inserted into that episode. This one thing that she got some kind of like, I don't know, spiritual fulfillment out of possibly, and they took it away.
Yeah,
now you don't have to.
At the bottom, at the very least, it's like a simple pleasure, something that she could do that didn't make her like sort of an automaton.
A robot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's interesting. I really loved and related to Laura in this. Not really related. I would never climb in a hot tub and spray bug spray necessarily, but like I found her very compelling. She's a rare, it's a rare figure to see on TV, is like a woman who is unhappy with her lot in life, and not because of like endless torment, but because she just is. She's depressed, yeah. You know? She's apathetic. She's faithless. You know, she talks about her lack of faith. And so, you know, she's got everything, quote unquote, that you might want. She's beautiful. Mm-hmm. She's got a lovely husband who adores her, who is gorgeous, and like all this sort of stuff. And
they have a house.
They have a house.
Big.
And, yeah.
All you know, appearances. Like,
they could start a family if they wanted to, and she's just not happy. And that to me seemed very, very real. But yeah, so we get this montage of them sort of like having sex and their relationship progressing, and then him sort of settling into normalcy mm-hmm. of a regular job, and her kind of wanting more. And they use the music cue of Garbage's Stupid Girl, as you say, with
such
the Roberta.
Such a great song. Such a great choice.
Yeah. It's so well deployed as she's walking, mm-hmm. as you say, into the casino over and over again. And then we see this scene where she's with Robbie and Audrey at their house at this barbecue. And the thing to notice, to point out about the scene, is that there's a pair of ravens sitting on the roof of the house sort of next door, spying on this whole scenario. And we'll see the ravens over and over again, but that's like, it's an important thing, I think, whenever you're watching this season and maybe future seasons, look for the ravens. And know that they are probably reporting to Odin what they see. So, Laura's plan to shake herself out of this like apathetic rut is to stage a casino heist. And it cuts from her saying, "This is a foolproof plan, we'll never get caught," to Shadow in custody and her saying, "How did you get caught?" And this is where she says, someone, like, there was no way we could have messed it up. And Shadow's like, I messed it up. She's like, nope, not even you, dummy.
not even you, puppy.
Not even you, puppy. So somebody messed up our plan. And Gail, what is our theory about this?
Well, our theory is that with that many ravens just hanging around all the time, probably Mr. Wednesday had some kind of thing to do with it, which would make a lot of sense if, you know, if Shadow is, as we suspect, more than just like some rando that Mr. Wednesday encountered on a plane and then chased off of a plane and then chased into a diner. And like, you know, like obviously Odin wants Shadow very specifically. Well, if that's the case, then it would make sense for him to engineer Shadow's life in his own direction, which also means it would make sense for him to engineer Laura out of the picture, since she's the one thing that seems to like make Shadow want to be normal and, you know, have a house and two kids and a minivan and all that kind of stuff.
Right. So if Wednesday has manipulated Shadow in, you know, pulling strings of the universe, manipulated Shadow into jail, and maybe later in this episode manipulating something else to put him exactly where he needs him for whatever it is he needs him for, which we don't know yet without getting into spoiler territory. So so Shadow goes into jail. Laura tries to take some of his sentence for him. Very honorable. He says no. He asks if she can wait. She says yes. We find out later that she was lying, because then we get another montage of Laura being like, man, life is hard when you're guys in the joint. And
I have to say, like, that, yeah, we later, she's very candid about the fact that she lied about it, and she, you know, overestimated, maybe dishonestly, her ability to, you know, be faithful for a period of 6 years or however long. But I did think that the conversation that she had with Shadow across the table when she's proposing that they rob the casino, that was a strikingly honest conversation.
Yes.
And anyone who's been in a long relationship where you have to make a confession like that to someone that says, I am not perfectly happy all the time like you are, and you need to understand that that's not your fault. And that's very difficult to do if you know that you are the reason that the other person is happy all the time. So for you to be unhappy,
yes,
hurts their happiness. And for her to just be like, I have come to this decision. I cannot live like this, and I know that this hurts you. but I have to tell you this. That was a real conversation that is happening all over the world all the time. And I have almost never seen it depicted as realistically as it was in that scene, because that's how like real people talk to each other when they're trying to explain, no, it's not you. Yes, it's me, but there's nothing I can do about it. And if you're going to have to help me with this. If See, this is work.
This is why I think this is such a good episode of television. Is like hopefully this is not an overshare, because actually this person can hear me right now, but I was watching this episode with our mutual friend and my roommate, and when that scene came up, she was like, that's me. I've had that conversation. And I've had that conversation too. Like
I've had that conversation too.
It is a real conversation and to have those kind of real conversations in a show about gods and mythology, I think it's just going to make the series better and better. And I don't know that we've had a lot of those like very real conversations yet. And I would like to see more of those, of just sort of like recognizing yourself for people that you know in this fantastical world is something that Neil Gaiman, I think, does really well, marrying human drama with the supernatural. And that's what The Ocean at the End of the Lane, as you mentioned earlier, that's what does like exquisitely. And so I think the more of that we can get in this show, the better show it will be. Yeah.
Yes.
So we have Laura start her affair with Robbie, which
I'm just loving Dane Cook in this series.
Perfect.
So much, which is a huge admission for me to make, because I have always thought that Dane Cook was the most obnoxious person on the face of the earth.
But he's perfectly cast as Robbie. Like, it's perfect. He's
perfect.
Yeah.
But it's also like it's really like making me warm to Dane Cook in a way, because I'm like, oh, good. You were just pretending this whole time. It's like when Ryan Reynolds played Deadpool and I was like, oh, thank Christ. You're self-aware. You know.
Well, yeah. No. When Dane Cook was cast in the series, people who hadn't read the book, a lot of people I know who hadn't read the book were really upset. And they're like, Dane Cook. I don't want to get any Dane Cook in my American Gods. I was like, no. He's Robbie. It's perfect.
This is perfect.
It's perfect. So, yeah. So Dane Cook is great.
He's doing such a good job too of just being gormless. he's just such a boob. I love him.
So Laura's cat dies. Robbie comes over and helps her bury it. They fall into this affair. I actually really like all the conversations that they have around it. And then, you know, we get the other side of the phone conversation we got in the first episode, where Shadow tells Laura he feels like something is coming, an ominous sort of sense of the gathering storm. And, you know, she says, we're looking forward to coming home. And we see that Robbie is there in her bed. And it's like, and then we cut to the car where you know, the music that they added to the scene, that whole element made the whole scene for me just like, it was cracking me up. So Dane Cook sings his way to a blowjobby death. And those ravens are once again on the scene, circling around the car, I believe, as it crashes, and then afterwards. And we get this moment that you've never seen Brian Fuller's series Dead Like Me, right?
I saw the first few episodes.
This was a very Dead Like Me shot. Yeah. When you see Laura sort of hovering over and looking down at her own body, that is like a classic Dead Like Me moment. And, you know, if you've seen all of Brian Fuller's work, you'll know he's obsessed with dead girls, Dead Like Me, Pushing Daisies, this episode. So once Laura's dead, like, we are in prime Brian Fuller territory. He's like, oh, a dead girl. I do dead girls real well. So
this is my wheelhouse, man.
Yeah, I got this. Tim Burton's got nothing on me. I got this. So Laura, the corpse bride, goes to the afterworld, and there she meets Anubis, Mr. Jekyll, who we met in an earlier episode. And this is a perfect opportunity for our other listener email, Gail.
This is from Jeremiah Rosen. who says, "Hi, Joanna and Gail. I'm really loving the show, and it's gotten me to start the book. I really liked last night's episode, especially the scenes between Laura and Jaquel, but I am a little confused about why she would even go to him in the afterlife. In last week's episode, it seems to me that Jaquel says the only reason he showed up for Mrs. Fadil was because of the stories she heard as a child and remembered throughout her life. So why would he show up for Laura, who doesn't believe in anything? I rewatched the scene, and I didn't see any obvious giveaways, but maybe I'm missing something. Do we just assume Jaquel shows up regardless? Or that it's related to the motif of the casino that Laura works at. Either way, I love the podcast. Thanks, Jeremiah." Thank you, Jeremiah. Joanna and I have a bit of a theory about that. This was, yeah, that was puzzling to me too. I couldn't figure, I was like, well, this seems to be stepping very much outside the idea of like personal mythologies, personal Jesuses, if you will. And so why would Laura really kind of get anybody when she finally dies, if she doesn't believe in anybody? Because the gods in this world seem to be very powered by individual belief. And Joanna was actually the one who found the moment that we had both kind of caught and then was, you know, sort of sticking around, rattling around in the back of our minds.
Oh, is that my cue?
That's your cue.
Mr. Jaquel.
Take it away. Credit to you.
Yeah. I don't know. We were just rewatching this scene right before we started recording. And cause we were like, he says something. What does he say? He says something. He says, "The circumstances of your death commit me." And how we're choosing to interpret that is that if Odin and his ravens are indeed responsible for Laura's death, that's why Mr. Jaquel is on the scene, because her death is, it's not a natural death. It's a supernatural death. And so either like, Odin asked Mr. Jaquel to sort of like escort Laura and make sure she gets safely where she needs to go, or some other reason. But yeah, you're right. Everyone sitting there thinking, why is Laura? What the fuck? Why is Laura in an Egyptian afterlife? But I think that's the reason why. And in addition to that, we get this great moment where he tries to sort of do what he did to Mrs. Fadil, which is weigh her heart against a feather, stuff like that. And Laura's like, you know what? I did what I did, for good or bad. I did it. Yeah, she skipped to the end. No, she was just like, she's like, no, like, F your rules. I like, no apologies. Like, yeah,
it was a very Big Bird moment.
Yeah, I was a shitty person.
Like, what do you think my heart feels like?
Yeah, I was a shitty person. Whatever, I did it. I'm not apologizing for anything. And then Mr. Jaquel conjures a hot tub and some bug spray and was basically like, you're going somewhere. Like, basically you're going, you believed in nothing, so you're going to nothing. That's what you get.
And Laura is also like, no to that too.
Yeah. Like,
no to all of your things.
Yeah, I believe she's like,
I didn't ask you. I believed in nothing, so I should get nothing. You are something. Go away.
She's like, fuck. She starts to say, fuck you. And that's when she gets yoinked back to the land of the living. And Mr. Jaquel has the best what the fuck like look on his face.
And he's like, what do I do with this hot tub now? Yeah. Go away. And like, put someone in.
Does the cat want to go into the hot tub now? I don't know. I don't know what to do with this hot tub. All right. So Laura crawls her way out of a grave. Good times. And then we get what Gail has aptly named Laura Vision, where we see the world from Laura's point of view. And in Laura's point of view, everything is kind of muted except for this bright glowing light, which we later find out is what Shadow looks to like to her now. He is the sunshine of her life, Stevie Wonder would say. And she follows it. And we get the scene from the first episode where Shadow is being lynched by the Technical Boys' children. Not 200. And Laura sort of starts beating the crap out of the children. And we find out that dead Laura has super strength. And what's your favorite death in this scene, Gail?
My favorite death in this scene is when Laura kicks a guy so hard in the crotch that his skull and spinal column explode out of the top of his head. And that is also the moment when Shadow is bathed in the blood of his creation. That was amazing.
That was an amazing scene.
And that was the guy who hit her in the arm with a crowbar, and her fuck you, Faith. She kicks him in the groin. I was like, we've all felt like that.
Yeah. When haven't you felt like life has hit you in the arm with a crowbar and you want to kick it in the groin until its head pops up? The only question mark I have about the scene is that moment where Laura sort of like spider monkeys up to Shadow's rope and breaks it. That I've seen it like 3 times now, and the wire work does not look amazing to me, but everything else in the scene is amazing. Laura winds up, unfortunately, with like an arm that then falls off, and then we get this great shot of Laura walking home just carrying her arm,
schlepping her arm
drenched in blood in her beautiful dress that she was buried in, and just like carrying that arm, and it's classic Brian Fuller dead girl moment.
She kicks her shoes off like, fuck this. Yeah, I'm going to carry my arm.
Fuck all of this. She gets home. And then we see her other side of a scene we've already seen, which is Shadow pack up his house in record time. And we find out that Laura was sort of sullenly hiding with her arm the whole time while he was there. And then she gets the bright idea to go over to Audrey's house, because it has already been established in this episode via montage that Audrey is a crafter, and she utilizes Audrey's crafting table to try to sew her arm back on her body. And then we get one of the most entertaining scenes of the episode.
Oh my God.
Which is Audrey discovering Laura and this whole interaction between Audrey and Laura, which I just loved. What did you think?
I loved every scene where Audrey and Laura had to talk to each other. And like, neither one of them wanted to be in the situation. This is so great about it, is that like Laura did not want to go back and bother Audrey. This was just like, where else is she going to go? Audrey crafts. And Audrey was like scared out of her mind and also so angry. Like, yeah. Like of all the people in the world, probably she wanted to see Laura even less than she wanted to see Robbie. Like, that's amazing. And Laura has to be, she's in the position of just being like, fucking no, I'm sorry. I can't think about your feelings. I need to use your toilet and I need you to sew my arm back on. And I'm just going to zombie be here scaring your fucking mind out of your body.
This is
until you help me with this. So sorry, but this is how it has to be. And it's just, it's a great depiction of like, what am I looking for? It's, an allegiance of necessity. Like, neither one of them wants to see each other at all, ever. It's so painful for both of them. It's so embarrassing for Laura. And Audrey is just, I love her admission, I'm a vulgar woman.
Yeah. But I just love, like, I kind of love, okay, so.
I identified deeply with both of those women.
Yeah.
I have never been dead. I have never been in Audrey's position before. And yet, I was like, I have had this fight. I've been on both sides of this.
Once again, another, like, really real, I don't know, depiction of female friendship almost. I don't know. But, like, the, weirdly. But. This is something that really does, in my opinion, have a source in the book, which is Laura sort of like vomiting up bugs and embalming fluid and stuff like that, which she does in the book. And so I'm glad that they didn't shy away from how disgusting it is for a corpse to be back on this earth.
Embalming fluid, I'm sorry.
And the toilet, I'm not usually one for toilet humor, but this was just perfectly deployed. And and then Laura just, you know, Audrey being like, I tried to have like sex with Shadow on your grave. I thought it was only fair. And Laura's like, that is fair. Like, she just like
both
calmly
of them are so
considers
debased
it. Yeah.
In this scene.
Yeah.
Like, there's just no dignity for either one of them. Like, Audrey's already been so shamed, you know, like she feels so humiliated by what happened to her and the fact that like everyone knows and it's her fault because she told everyone and she was drunk at the funeral and she tried to have sex with Shadow on Laura's grave. Like, she just feels terrible about herself, and like it's sort of like public knowledge. And then Laura has to be in the position of just being so grossed out by herself. Like, she's the grossest object in the world right now, and she still has to come here and ask for help from a person who hates her. It's great. It's just great to see, like, no one has any dignity. No one's pretending to be on a pedestal right now.
But then it just makes so much sense to me that this ends with Audrey helping her. Like, it all just makes sense along the lines of human nature to me that this ended not with Audrey kicking her out, but with Audrey actually helping her. And
like sort of like a sisters in arms kind of situation. Like, just, you know.
What else are you going to do? I also want to, like, so shout out to Betty Gilpin, who plays Audrey. I think she's amazing. I think she's so funny and like emotionally real. And shout out again to this episode for giving us more dimension to Audrey, which the book does not afford. You know, Audrey's in that one scene, basically, or two quick scenes. But to have her here and throughout this episode just gives her story so much more. And I, you know, that scene doesn't pass the Bechdel test because they're like talking about Shadow and they're talking about Robbie, but it, like, in my heart it does, because it's about their friendship, you know? So
honestly, those the men in their life are really just an excuse to talk about, like, themselves and their own personal dignity. And, like, when, you know, it's a great, it doesn't matter, like, who did what, or actually the fact that there were any men involved at all. When Laura says, "I'm so sorry, I feel terrible," and Audrey says, "Fuck your feelings."
Yeah. So good. Or when Laura was like,
Laura could have done anything.
Yeah. And Laura's like, "It wasn't really about you." And, like, Audrey's like, "Yeah, why would it be? It's about my best friend and my husband. Why would it be about me?" And that's fine. Yeah. So it's a great scene. Great. And then Laura asks if she can borrow her car. And then we cut to Laura and Audrey on a road trip, which I'm actually sad didn't last longer.
I wanted that to last longer.
Right? Yeah. And there's a great conversation where
like two more episodes of Audrey in the car.
Right? And there's this great conversation that echoes actually the conversation that Laura and Robbie had earlier in the episode, which is just about Laura's feelings for Shadow. They're both basically like, don't really love him. He's like a pet to you. You certainly don't love him the way he loves you. All this sort of stuff. And Laura is sort of saying, like, yeah, that was true then, but I love him now. And we'll see sort of how this plays out, but the idea of being dead, coming back to life, and everything is gray except this other thing that is the sunshine, the warmth and the sunshine in your life, like, that makes sense to me that Laura's attitude has shifted, you know, here.
Yeah. And I would say in my own head and heart, I'm still not convinced that she actually loves him the way that he loves her. I don't think that that's true. But I also think that there's an aspect of Shadow's love for Laura that is untrue in and of itself, because to me, it's clear that he never really knew her or understood her.
Yeah.
And until you can see, like, those dark parts of a person, can you really be said to love them? And I also, by the way, I really appreciated, because we talked about it, what a terrible nickname, pet name, if you will, puppy is.
Yes.
The origin story for the puppy nickname was, like, great in this episode, actually. And, like, puppy became sort of a bittersweet reminder to Laura on a daily basis that basically, like, Shadow was kind of her charity case pet. Yeah.
It's like calling her cat Dummy.
Which I had a cat named Dummy when I was a kid. He was the sweetest cat ever. I loved him.
Then we meet we've already met Mr. Jekyll, and we actually have already seen Mr. Ibis, but we meet the dream team together in a great introduction, because we see Ibis and Jekyll dog form sort of walk into the road. The car stops, and then the actor who plays Jekyll, Chris Obie, just sort of stands up. And you don't get, like, cheesy CGI where you see the dog turn into the man. Mm-mm. It's just like, it's a dog, then he's hidden by the car, and then it's a man, and it's just, like, beautifully done. And
the look on his face was like, were you going to stop?
And then he's basically like, he told Laura before in the afterlife, like, you're just a stupid girl, basically, and I'm not going to remember you, and you're nobody to me. And then this time he goes, now I remember you. Well, that's not quite what he says, but basically that. And then we get taken to the Ibis and Jekyll funeral home, which has been in business there for 200 years. And this is something from the book, but it's not Laura who goes there. It's Shadow. Mm. But here it's Laura. We talked a little bit about Mr. Ibis, who is Osiris, right? And Mr. Jekyll, who's Anubis. And since they are lords of the afterlife, it makes sense that they are undertakers. And they give like decomposing, poorly sewn on Laura the sort of death becomes her makeover, like a spray tan. Everything's sort of beautifully knitted together. Audrey disappears without any explanation, which is a bummer. But Laura gets her lovely makeover. What did you think of this sequence?
Oh, I love Ibis already. I mean, we've sort of seen him. We've heard his narration and we've seen his hand presumably writing with a feather quill. But I just love him. He's prim and he's slightly fussy and he's sort of bird-like. He's just doing a wonderful job of personifying the scribe of the gods. And Jaquel, I love that actor. He's doing a wonderful job, but it was great to see the dog, actually, because it was this sort of like ambiguous Doberman kind of, you know, jackal looking creature with, you know, pointed ears and a long squared off nose. But for the rest of the episode, like there's a shot of him where he comes up, like his face comes up the side of the, you know, the embalming table. And I can't remember what it is that he's saying to Laura, but it's basically like, when this is over, I will come for you and I will send you into the darkness. And if you've ever been like coldly appraised by a dog that's making up its mind how it feels about you, it was just I was like, this is great. You guys are doing such a good job of interpreting these animals. And that's a fun thing about Egyptian mythology, is that the gods they are animals, and we love to anthropomorphize. Human beings love to do that. And so, you know, you look at old paintings of Anubis, and he does, man, he looks super serious. and you know, he has that sort of Doberman-like quality where you just don't want to fuck with that dog. But he's, at the same time, he's just like, he seems like such an honest character. Both of them seem straightforward, diligent, and honest. They are executing their jobs to the very best of their ability. And they can afford to be a little flexible. They can accommodate, but they will not bend or break the rules.
Right. So Laura basically gets a stay of stay of execution.
She gets a stay because of extenuating circumstances.
she's got this,
because she's still walking around.
She's got this coin. It's very unusual. Mean, we I don't think we see, do we see the coin in this episode?
No, we never see it. And that's the weirdest thing. Where is it? She has to have it on her person somewhere, right? Is it? Did she swallow it? What's going on?
Does her dress have pockets? What's happening? But anyway, we don't see the coin, but but the coin affords her protection for now. And then we get the final scene where Laura has thoughtfully packed a dress that maybe we can assume is Shadow's favorite. It's one we saw her wear earlier. Yeah. And she changes out of like her more slovenly clothes into this beautiful dress. She's gotten this gorgeous makeup from Ibis and Jackal. And she's just ready to greet Shadow. She's sitting on his bed and we see a scene we've seen before, but from her perspective. So the glowing Shadow, and she says, "Hello, puppy." And Shadow's like, "Oh, damn." So that is the end of this episode. Now that we talked about it, I'm not trying to force you to like this episode more than you did, but like, now that we talked about it, have your feelings changed about it, or are you still feeling like, you know, not your favorite, but pretty good?
Well, okay. Now, when I, like, in terms of like what my favorite of anything is, if you were to put in front of me, you know, a plate of raw kale and then like a plate of, you know, I don't know, triple cream brie. I mean, my favorite one is the brie, but the kale is better for me. So
you're calling this the roughage of episodes.
This is the roughage of the show. Uh-huh. Because like, this is what's going to make it actually meaningful and not just a thing that I'll have to be reminded of in 10 years and be like, oh my fucking God, that was a show. That's right. Oh, that was hilarious. No, this was a good episode. If you're going to ask me like my personal favorites, they tend to be slightly more feel good things, but it also, like, for me, talking about the episode and finding those like moments of common ground, you know, my delight at Audrey and Laura's forced friendship with each other, like being stuck in this situation where they have to deal with each other and they're not going to like mince words about their feelings because who fucking cares anymore?
Fuck your feelings.
Moments, fuck your feelings. Moments like that. She's so funny. Fuck your feelings. her delivery was amazing.
I recommend you all try that in a fight or a conversation this week. Fuck your feelings. Yeah.
See how that goes.
And Gail, when you and I, like next time we fight, as friends sometimes do, I encourage you to use that phrase to break the tension.
Probably will. Like you, that's a phrase you can deploy when your opponent is so egregiously in the wrong that they will just nod. Like you have to be so assured that they really
really
fucked your husband
the moral equivalent of dying with your husband's penis in their mouth, whatever that is, then you can say fuck your feelings. All right, so that is season 1, episode 4, Get Gone. We are officially halfway through the season. And I am excited to see where we go. This was an Odin-free episode, which is interesting. And I'm excited to see more of Laura. And yes. I really think Emily Browning is so well cast in this role. And I'm glad that we got to see all these other sides of Shadow. And I hope we haven't seen the last of Audrey. And
me too.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say about this episode, Gail? It's actually a kind of light on gods generally.
That's kind of why I said, like, to me, it's more in line with the sort of Ocean at the End of the Lane kind of. It was very focused on humanity and, you know, the human experiences and not knowing what's going on and what's going to happen, you know, because the gods tend to be slightly smug. They've been around for a really long time. They've got their little thing figured out. I mean, Odin being the smuggest of all. But humans, you know, when confronted with that, with mortality, you know, frequently most people can't afford to be smug because it's scary and you don't know what's going on. And it's fraught with sadness. And a lot of that came through in this episode, but there were moments when he, you know, the humanity of the characters touched the divine, and it was, that was powerful. It was good. But I think the most striking thing about it was that those moments were completely superseded, and outshone by the moments of humans interacting with humans.
Beautifully put.
Thank you.
Until next week, where can people find you online, Gail?
I am at Clockwork Rose on Twitter.
So you can send us any corrections or questions or comments or concerns to at Storm of Spoilers, at Clockwork Rose, at Joe Wrote This, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. You can read my work, including that interview with Neil Gaiman, where he talks about sort of the rest of the season and season 2 and a bunch of other things, and American Gods book sequel, and George R. R. Martin, and all kinds of stuff over on vanityfair.com. Until next week, only the gods are real.